This is a football fans podcast and the people behind CelticUnderground.net. There's been a lot going on at Celtic in the last week or so, and so I thought I'd get together Duncan and Hullboy to discuss the plethora of problems that we have faced. Playing on a plastic pitch, putting in a pathetic performance, the ragdolling of Julian, the silly penalty he gave away, and that was just the Kilmarnock game. Then, of course, we've got the incredible circumstances of Ballingolly, whether we think the Scottish Government was justified in their instruction to football, and then general conversation about what we hope to get out of the transfer window. Anyway, enough of me, let's go straight into the chat. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Duncan, and Hullboy. So we've got a lot to talk about, so we'll go straight into it, joined by Hullboy and Duncan. How you doing, Andy? You doing good?
I'm good, thanks. Harry, yeah.
How's the Hull Riviera today?
It's dull and drizzly.
Oh. Duncan, how are you?
I'm very well, sir. Very well. Looking forward to this. Thanks for having me again, Harry.
How's the West End Riviera?
It's dull and drizzly in Las Vegas West End, I can confirm.
Okay, so with dull and drizzly over the UK for the summer, we'll get straight on to the Kilmarnock game, first of all. So, Andy, you can kick us off. What went right, what went wrong in the Kilmarnock game? I saw a tremendous Duco James stuck up. I think neither team had expected goals, managed to reach one in that game. It should have finished 0-0, not 1-1. So, yeah. Andy, your thoughts on it?
Well, thoughts are roughly similar to every time we see games on plastic pitches. I've never, ever seen a decent game on a plastic pitch. And, you know, obviously you can see you're disappointed. It just kind of sucks the life out of what I understand football to be in terms of a spectacle. So you kind of go into those games just thinking, well, you know, can we just get through this with whatever win is needed? And obviously the Christie goal put us on the right path, and you kind of think, well, you know, that's us set up for a victory. Kilmarnock weren't really causing any threat. I mean, obviously their striker was doing bits and pieces. And then really they got a penalty out of nothing. It was a silly mistake by Julian. He knew he'd made the mistake, even though he kind of wagged his finger at the referee initially. He knew that he'd messed up. But even after the penalty, you thought that Celtic would kind of like come back into it. And really, we, you know, leaving the pitch to one side, we were just very poor on the day, and kind of like, I mean, I was kind of like 15 minutes into the second half and thinking nothing's going to come of today. So very disappointing.
Duncan?
Yeah, I mean, I echo a lot of what's been said there, and I also agree. I can't ever remember seeing a good game of football on a plastic pitch, and I actually find it quite embarrassing that three teams in our league, so that's like a quarter, right, have plastic pitches. I just think it's in this day and age, when you, if you happen to be a casual observer now on Sky down south, and you happen to land on a game and you watch what's been played on that pitch, I find it very embarrassing. It looks like lower league football. And I noticed as well that they had also, there were some brown lines on the pitch. They'd brought the pitch in even tighter to stifle it, and it's just, I just think in this day and age, to have three teams in our league playing on that type of surface, this is not sour grapes, I've said this for years, and I actually think that this league this season potentially could be won and lost, because you're playing at least nine games on those types of surfaces, and then you've got the other four games against Rangers. Those 13 games, in my opinion, are where the league will be won and lost. But the game was dreadful. I can't think of a single Celtic player that I could say was even a 6 or 7 out of 10. We were just dreadful from every single player. I thought Elyounoussi was absent. I thought that, albeit he got a goal, which the goal he should have got, Christie was nowhere, but I'm singling those two out. We were absolutely dreadful, but Kilmarnock played as well. And if I was a manager and I was playing at home against Celtic, that's exactly how I'd play against them.
You mentioned about the lines being brought in. So being a sad man, I went online and looked at the dimensions of Celtic's pitch and the official dimensions of Kilmarnock's pitch. But the dimensions that I found online were 2 years old. So I did a quick back of a fag packet of, it looked like the touchline had been brought in maybe a metre, right? From the, you know, the length of the pitch. And the width of the pitch, it looked like a metre in, sort of reducing by a metre the width of the pitch. And then behind the goals, you could see the penalty area being moved. So it looked as though it had been brought in about 2-3 metres, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem much. Well, it's 1 metre this way and 2-3 metres that way. But when you then multiply that up in the square area, I worked out roughly 450 square metres of a difference in the total playing area, which, being a sad property man that I am, that's a one-bedroom flat. That is a modern one-bedroom flat smaller to play on, right? Now, I know my point about that then is we play a system at Celtic Park on a pitch and then take that system to a pitch which is a one-bedroom flat smaller in total area space. Should we consider, Andy, do you think we should consider more, a bit more of a horses for courses in changing the system and the players on the park from when we go to a really tight pitch like that?
Well, yes and no. I think for me, the pitch had been reduced. And strangely enough, I think I'm right in saying that when Kilmarnock used to play on grass, their pitch in size terms was on a par with Celtic's and Rangers. Yep. It was one of the largest pitches in Scottish football.
And famously was one of the best playing surfaces because they never got, they are, they never really get snow and ice.
Exactly. So I think the thing for me was that, yes, Celtic played the same system, but actually where Killy were pretty good was that they actually crowded that place around the kind of the D on the 18-yard box. So Celtic's movement in that area was really, really restricted, and that's why Edouard didn't get much joy on the day, and Elyounoussi just kind of drifted away from there because they couldn't get any joy in that part of the pitch, really. So it wasn't really... It wasn't really about the width necessarily on the day of the pitch. I think it was that's where Celtic's inventiveness comes to the fore. And because Kilmarnock crowded it out, and, you know, fair play to Alex Dyer as the coach. He clearly, you know, gave his team instructions and they played to those instructions. So that was what did it for me, really, rather than the width of the pitch and, you know, whether Celtic need to adapt. I mean, having said that, obviously Lenny changed it eventually in the second half to a 3-5-2, but, you know, with kind of little effect, really.
Duncan, one of the things you mentioned earlier, and you see, Duncan, so Edouard, when he's not getting, as you point out, Andy, Edouard, when he's not getting the ball, tends to drift out of the box and drift a bit out and left and back and left.
Yeah.
And Elyounoussi tends to be starting the left and cut in. So for me, one of the problems, I don't know if Duncan, you mentioned about Elyounoussi. For me, one of the problems is because Duncan, Elyounoussi and Edouard then end up playing in roughly the same spot.
I've made the same observation as well. That's where Edouard naturally drifts out to, and Elyounoussi naturally drifts in, and it doesn't work for me. And I think that Back to your earlier point there, I think we've sort of got an approach at Celtic is that other than Rangers, whenever we play anybody, it doesn't matter who we pick and how we play, we should blow everybody away. But that blatantly isn't the case when you go to somewhere like Kilmarnock and you're basically having a game of football in the NA. You're playing in a bit of concrete in a tight, confined space, and that's a very small bedroom flat that you're marketing there, Brian. But I think that it was markedly different last year post Christmas when we came back and Neil went 3-5-2. You know, I don't know any Celtic fans that don't think that that's not our best formation, irrespective of where we're playing. But I just don't think there was the personnel to play with that. I think that would be the preferred system to go away to Kilmarnock with two up front. And I imagine that will now be Edward and Ajeti, I imagine, will be the starting two up front, and we'll go 3-5-2. Assuming that boy's fit. But yeah, it was just, there was nothing. I think we had two shots on target, one being the goal, which must have been for at least 40 yards. Mm-hmm. And then I think Edward had a shot from about 30 yards that the goalie could have stopped with his foot. We just had nothing because, as Andy says, they crowded us out round about the sort of 20, 25 yards out, and it was stifling. It almost suffocated us.
One of the interesting things you were saying about playing two up front, I can't remember if it was on the podcast or we had a long chat off the podcast when we were speaking to Duco James, and he was talking about the numbers last season when we played 3-5-2, and he said that the stats for Edward were remarkable because he had the stats of a fantastic number 10. I mean, granted, his point was, granted, it's in the SPFL, so it's not the same level of opposition, he said, but he had the stats of, like, Messi playing as a false nine or a number 10, and also the stats of a top player playing as a number 9 up front in the same game, that he was adding so much to the team creatively and adding so much to the team as in the box as a goal scorer. Andy, how do you like the 3-5-2 idea?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's been debate raging probably for the last decade about two up front in whatever Celtic team has been playing. And I think the thing for me, the missed opportunity for me, which I think we were all kind of salivating over, was Dembele and Edward.
Yeah.
Who were due to be the front two, and then we obviously know what happened with the debacle of Dembele and the Rodgers fallout and all the rest of it. So we've never really seen that kind of consistent two. So if Ajeti is being signed as the second striker with Edward, I'll be happy with that. It worked slightly with Griffiths, I think. Griffiths tends to play his own game. I think there are other strikers who can work probably better with Edward in a fixed front two. And as I say, hopefully Yeti can be that player. I'd be happy with that. I think the other thing with a 3-5-2 is we're putting pressure on our... Sounds odd, but we're putting pressure on our back three in terms of ensuring that they stay fit, because we're lacking at the back in terms of the people who can actually come in and play in that back three. It's okay if you've got Aya fit. It's okay if you've got Julian fit.
El Hamid would be the third.
And El Hamid would be the third. Yeah.
Or Beaton. But I actually think that in a 3-5-2, I actually think, and I get the point on the fitness, I think it suits Aya and Julian better when they're in a three rather than just the two of them. I think it suits them if they've got El Hamid or a Beaton or previously a Simonovic or somebody like that. I think that they play better in a three.
Yeah.
I tell you one thing on that three aspect, actually, because obviously the downside of a three is if you play a better team and they push their fullbacks and their wingers on, you can easily end up being very uncreative and playing with a five because your wing backs then have to come back and deal with that. But
who's going to do that apart from in Europe?
Well, exactly. So it's only in Europe that it really matters. But for me, a lot of talk about Julian struggling to cope with a big physical striker. Now, Andy and Duncan, you're there or thereabouts of my age, so you will have the same memory of me. I seem to recall people rubbish but burly strikers like Tony Rougie at Raith Rovers. And at the same time, Hearts had a big guy who was a big lump against everybody else but seemed to cause our centre-halves all sorts of problems. For me, the issue is the way we have always played. Our full-backs are right up the park.
Yeah.
You then have a really big guy who runs the channels. If you're playing with a flat back four and you have a big guy who then runs into the corner, you just pass him on to the fullback and the fullback go and deals with him. Yeah. Our problem is our fullbacks are on and our centre-halves deal with this big burly guy who's just physical and awkward. He runs into the corner and our centre-half is then pulled way out into the corner. And that's, if the guy's big enough that he can hold the ball up, that's what then causes the problem. Because our centre-half's followed him off into the corner because our full-backs are halfway up the pitch.
I think for me as well, it's kind of exception rather than the rule as well. I mean, you know, you tend to see those games like Livingston last year where obviously Celtic were on the wrong end of a result. And so people pick up on that and, you know, kind of really, really put the spotlight on people like Julian. But Julian's also come up against other players who've got, you know, similar attributes, and he's not particularly had a problem with them. Who was the big striker at Hearts?
Who
actually could be a real handful. And yeah. You know, against when we played against him last season, you know, he didn't cause him any problems. And actually, he was the player at the time before a ball was kicked that I thought, oh yeah, he could be the one that does some damage against us. And I know Hearts were poor last year, but you know, it's as I say, I think it's exception rather than rule.
So, Duncan, do you think there's any thought process going on in Celtic Park about how we deal with our poor performances on plastic pitches?
I've got no idea. You certainly like to think so. I mean, I don't know what the answers are. I back to your previous point. Why would you play on Celtic Park, like a huge, big, expansive, multi-million-pound surface that's exceptional, and play really wide, fast-flowing football, and then when you go and play in a piece of concrete down in Ayrshire, go with the same system and the same players? That seems pretty basic to me that you wouldn't do that. And I think you have to have, or we have to have, a game plan for how we go to Kilmarnock and Livingston and to Hamilton, not necessarily around the players, because I think all three teams will play in exactly the same way against us, but we've got to do something different. There's a little bit of a trend emerging here that we do struggle on these surfaces, therefore we need to do something different if we want to get a different result.
On the penalty itself, Andy, to me, it just seems so basic. The guy was hemmed in by the touchline, hemmed in goal side by Julian, hemmed, and then Brown arrives, so he's hemmed in, like moving to his left by Brown, so he can only run away from goal. But for some reason, Julian left like a foot and a half of space between himself and the byline. It was a good piece of skill by the guy because he had his back to Julian, flicked the ball, turned, and went. But if Julian had just stood his ground and was just 80 inches closer to the touchline, the guy would have just run straight into Julian. I've seen a few people online saying that he switched off. You could see his body language. He switched off for a split second as Brown arrives because he thinks it's being dealt with. Do you think there's any merit in that?
I think there's possible. I mean, who knows what's going through his mind? I think the thing for me is, you know, professional footballers, they've got all the professional tricks in their armoury, and very often those professional tricks work. And one of those is the kind of the physical things that you do apart from tackling. So you will bump into an opponent to put him off without fouling him. You will put a hand out or an arm out to try and stop him running. And I think when it came down to it, the thing for me was, yes, it was a decent piece of skill by the Killie player, but actually, if Julian had let him go, where was he going to go following that? Because Barkas would have had his near post covered. Mm-hmm. I think, obviously, we've not seen enough of him yet, but he possibly is good enough to get down and cut out what may have been a cross by the player, because there was another Killie player in the 6 yard area, and there was also another defender. Callum McGregor, right? Okay, I knew there was somebody else who would have cut out the cross, even if Barkas had not got to it. So for me, Julian just did that professional thing, and. People talk about body language. The thing that I noticed was, as I said, Julian wagged his finger at the referee and then put it down pretty quickly, because he knew he'd been found out, and it was a clear penalty. So
it was a ridiculous penalty. I mean, for all the reasons that you just given there, you just see him out the pitch or give him nowhere to go and get nice and tight. But first things first, the ball was blatantly out on the touchline.
Yeah.
Like 10 seconds before the penalty, the ball goes out. By some distance, it goes out. And there was actually an instant in the second half where the ball goes out again and the same linesman misses it, which is, I think, it's just really, it's ridiculous. But yeah, it's a stonewall penalty. There's no need for it. He's going nowhere. And I was a bang average centre half. That's where I played. And I was coached, just jockey him out. That's just and get tight to him. So if he turns and runs into you, you're not going to concede a foul or a penalty if he runs into you. It's his problem. It was just absolutely ridiculous. And I don't think a single Celtic player complained other than Julian wagging his finger.
No, in fact, talking to McGregor being in the middle, actually the camera angle that Killie had that was down low from behind the goal, you see Callum McGregor going mental at Julian for doing it. So so that was 1-1. The only other thing of note that really happens in that game is about 5 minutes to go, when there was a couple of things that struck me about it. The camera pans to Lennon and Kennedy having a conversation about what should we do.
Yeah.
And patently, Lennon's suggesting bringing somebody on, and Kennedy's body language is, might as well, type thing. Not, yeah, that sounds great. It was, why not? Might as well give it a try. And it was ball and golly. And so, Andy, your thoughts on the whole ball and golly situation?
Well, I mean, in coming on there, I thought it was very good of Killie, actually, to kind of like, put that little kind of frame around him, saying nothing to declare as he kind of came to unbelievable.
Well, you see, he had flown into Prestwick, so maybe he was just down in the general...
Yeah, exactly, yeah. He just handed his meal tray over to John Kennedy as he came on, you know. obviously at the time we didn't really think much of Ballingolly coming on, other than, you know, this is the last throw of the dice in the game, you know. And, you know, I mean, Greg, as Duncan said, Greg Taylor had been as effective, stroke ineffective, as every other Celtic player on the park. So by that time you just didn't think twice about it. But kind of fast forward 48, 72 hours, and we realised that kind of it was just a complete mess in terms of having kind of included Ballingolly in the game in the last 10 minutes and the fallout that came from that. I mean, what can I say? It's just Unbelievable. So
Duncan, the thing that strikes me, who goes to Spain for a day?
maybe somebody that wants a move to Spain, I don't know.
Well, you see, that's just it. I know he's denied it. I can't help think he was overseeing a club or something, because I just can't call him. I know the weather in Scotland has been crap for July and the beginning of August. In fact, it improved there. So I get the concept that if you're from Europe, you might be fed up with it raining every second day in Glasgow. But for a day?
I know, and from the picture that I've seen of him sat, and it's not exactly inconspicuous, I think I might have gone with like a black trackie, a hoodie and a mask and a baseball cap. he looks like somebody's coated him in glue and rolled him through the Gucci factory. He's sat in the front row, and he's on his own as well, which again, if he'd been with maybe with his missus or something, you think maybe that makes me think that it's maybe more business. But either way, it's just unfathomable. I actually think that the Aberdeen lads, I can get that happens.
Yeah.
I sat in a pub yesterday with some friends and had a few beers and had some food and wasn't doing anything. I understand, but the ball and golly thing, it defies logic. And I mean, let's call it, he's actually rank rotten as a player. And it was even one of my friends who's govern facing suggested as a punishment we should have to play him the whole season. but he's rotten. But it's just, the thing is, there's nothing, unless a club, there's nothing we can do about that. You can't plan and budget for that level of stupidity. It's just mind-blowingly stupid to think that you can do something like that and get away with it. It defies all logic. And it tells me, not only do I think he's appalling as a footballer, it also just tells me everything I need to know about his character. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say we won't be seeing him again on the pitch for Celtic.
Yeah, he'd get booed at a behind closed door games. That's how bad it is what he's done.
I'd agree with Duncan there. I think that we won't see him again. I think that the galling thing is for me is as along with obviously a lot of other supporters and Peter Lowell, Neil Lennon, everybody at the club. You know, as Celtic have said, Celtic have been at the forefront of trying to get football restarted. Yeah. And they've got all this joint response group and, you know, the kind of relationship between SFA, SPFL and the Scottish Government. But actually, reading between the lines, you can see that Celtic have been really proactive in trying to build up the confidence of the Scottish Government to allow football to kind of start again, you know. And it's almost as though they're kind of one step ahead in that they're saying, right, okay, we've reached that milestone of training. We've then reached the milestone of training in groups. We've then reached the milestone of starting the season on the 1st of August. And Celtic were already ahead of the game of saying, obviously putting pressure on to say, look, when can we start trialling supporters getting back into the stadium? And the most galling thing about the Bollingoli situation is that he's just gone completely rogue, completely acted out of his own self-interest. And the whole thing has been kind of put at Celtic's door, when actually Celtic have done everything that they possibly could to kind of manage the environment that they're operating within in terms of COVID, and also to be, as I say, proactive about getting the game restarted and back to some kind of normality. So when you see Lennon giving the press conference and him talking about being livid and appalled, I'd say that's just 10% of how he feels. He must be absolutely raging, and the club must be absolutely raging. And I think the thing for me is, in terms of what's come out, is, you know, apparently Bollingoli denied that he even went to Spain at first. He denied to the club that he went to Spain. And obviously the evidence is there. So one can only think that he denied it because he was going to see another club.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you noticed in the press conference, when one of the media asked Lennon about that, Lennon actually responded and said, well, he'll be in even bigger trouble if that's the case.
Well, the thing about that is part of the reason why I'm not going to. This is not a defence of Ballingolly. It's a criticism of his agent if he's done that.
Yeah,
because I can expect that if he's similar to Scottish footballers, he might not be the bright, or some Scottish footballers, he might not be the brightest lad, right? English is not his first language, so I don't suspect he's watched I wouldn't be surprised if he's not watched a second of British news coverage of the coronavirus stuff, right? So when all of that into consideration, I can imagine his attitude is slightly, if the planes are flying, I must be allowed to go. So if he's looking for another club, that would be his agent who'd be involved in that.
Yeah.
And so his agent has allowed him, who would be more educated and more informed, his agent has allowed him to get on a plane to a country that you're not allowed to go to. And then him and his agent between them have contrived to cover it up.
Yeah, and I don't know. I genuinely don't know anything on this, but I agree with you. And I think it's blatantly obvious to me, the guy's as bright as 2 o'clock in the morning. And the fact of the matter is, at the level that Ballingolly is, and the level that he's getting paid, and the level of any potential transfer, for about a week's wages for Ballingolly, they could have chartered a plane and gone to Spain and seen somebody. But no, they probably booked it for £90 on Ryanair. But to be fair, he's gone all out because he's paid extra for the front row and the extra leg room.
I actually looked online, by the way, because I'm a sad man. Currently, you can fly from Prestwick to Malaga for $14.99, including taxes.
and I would say that's probably the market value for him, to be fair.
So, yeah, so my issue is slightly that I don't believe he went because he was so fed up with the rain that he needed one day of sunshine. No, I think
there are other countries that you can go to that aren't or weren't on the quarantine. Like, he could have at that time, he could have flown to Nice. And spent a night in Nice because France wasn't on the. He could have gone to Amsterdam. He could have gone anywhere. That tells me that's not a social call. I don't believe it is. But just on the whole thing, and I don't know if you read the Chris Sutton piece in the Record yesterday. I really liked it.
Yeah, it was excellent.
It was very good, and it was. I'm really glad that he's said it, because I've been saying it all week.
Yeah.
The way in which footballers are being treated, especially the Aberdeen lads,
correct.
I think it is absolutely outrageous. And when you hear the language that Jason Leach and Nicola Sturgeon are using, and they talk about potential sanctions being things like community service, I think it is absolutely outrageous for them to speak about players like that. And community service is something that criminals, I think the language around it, and it's footballers, there's a real bugbear in mind. See, if that had been rugby players, there wouldn't have been the outcry that there's been. And I think that the language that's been used around it from government has been appalling.
I had that very same conversation yesterday, Duncan, having read the Chris Sutton article, which was really excellent piece. And I think the thing is, you know, we know the makeup of Scottish football. We know the makeup of Celtic. And I think, you know, this talk about privilege, and yes, it at one level it is a privilege to be a professional footballer, but the economic reality of professional football in Scotland is very different from the economic reality of professional football in England in terms of players' wages and salaries. And you got to look at some of these SPFL players, and you can probably include some of those Aberdeen players in that their annual wage is going to be on a par with a lot of other working people, no more. And certainly in the lower clubs in the Scottish Premiership. So I absolutely agree with you in terms of the way in which Nicola Sturgeon and Jason Leach have approached this. And the rugby issue, for me, I can almost see it down the line that we will see misdemeanours in rugby when that resumes, and it will just be kind of swept under the carpet. I can almost see it now.
Yeah, do you know, sorry.
No, it's just... No, carry on, Duncan, carry on.
No, on you go.
I was just going to say, the whole incident, And this is the problem. If you try to have a debate with someone on social media has to be a black or white, and there's no nuance to it. And so if you do what I did, which I engaged with a couple of people criticising the Scottish Government's response, by implication, I was defending Ballingolly in their eyes, right? Which isn't true.
No.
Ballingolly was an arsehole who I could have strangled because I knew of what would arise from it.
Yeah.
And the stupidity of it. It demonstrated actually the hypocrisy of human beings that is played out on social media. So for the last 3 months, I have seen Celtic social media, which is principally left-leaning, being very critical of the likes of Wetherspoons and other companies who've not treated their workers correctly. Those same people rushing online to tear up every piece of employment law on Ballingolly and being in uproar at the possibility that Celtic players might actually have days off. You know, because first of all, it came out that it was illustrated the worst of social media. One person says, I hear they had 4 days off, and suddenly it's a disgrace that they got 4 days off with no evidence for it. It then comes back to they've had 2 days off, i.e. a weekend, except they play at the weekend, so their 2 days off, their weekend, in inverted commas, was the Monday-Tuesday or the Tuesday-Wednesday, right? So there's that aspect of it. There's the fact that they're about to enter a period where they won't get any weekends. They won't get 2 days off. But the club still have a statutory obligation to give them time off, and so they probably front-load it to give them that time off. And I saw a very well-known, very left-wing celebrity Celtic fan wanting all employment rights torn up for Ballingolly. Wrote a piece about it for Russia TV or something, wanting all employment rights torn up for Ballingolly, principally because Ballingolly earns more than the average salary in the UK. I mean, I do want to know where in this guy's head your earnings mean that you no longer have any employment rights whatsoever. So there's that side of things. And the other side of it, that point that I made to people, was when the exam fiasco, I woke up in the morning and thought, Swinney's making a statement today talking about how they have completely mucked up on the exams, and football has just given them an alternative story to stick in. And so it was no surprise to me how much of a kicking. Why is our ban for one player for games less in time than Aberdeen's?
Yep.
And so if you're using medical grounds for this, why was the Aberdeen midweek game allowed to go ahead and then because of Ballingolly it was cancelled? And why, if the reason we're not allowed to play is because we had a player and the incubation period is such that because that player interacted with other Celtic players, we need to give time for the negative results to come through because the incubation period, you could have false negatives. So why were Kilmarnock still playing? Because the Kilmarnock players interacted with him. So if it's on medical reasons, the Kilmarnock players, so getting back to the Chris Sutton article point, this was purely giving a high-profile footballer a kicking. That was the only reason for doing it.
I think for me, Harry, there's two things there. One on your latter points there. We've been told since COVID started that, you know, politicians are following the science. Well, there's no science being followed in that decision-making process.
No.
As you said, there are too many anomalies there. And there are too many anomalies, not just in terms of the confines of Scottish football, but in terms of other incidents within football across Europe, in terms of what's happening in COVID-related issues. And I think the other thing for me, and it's more concerning, is regardless of their political alignment, politicians will be politicians. And Scottish football, the authorities need to be very, very wary of this because there has been this link that's now being made between political decision making and football decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And at one level, probably all of our initial reactions were, yes, Aberdeen have been in the wrong, Celtic have been in the wrong, regardless of whether it's down to individual players. And probably most of us reasonably have accepted that. But politicians will always look for, not an ulterior motive, but they will always look for the political motive. Mm-hmm. And I think what the SPFL and the SFA need to be very, very careful about through the JRG is that the politicians don't start to kind of do two things. One is inadvertently run Scottish football, in quotation marks, and secondly, to exact things that they want to see from Scottish football. Because it's not a giant leap to see that the Scottish government have always wanted football in Scotland to do certain things, which Scottish football has always resisted. Mm-hmm. And said, actually, some of those things are not our problem, they're societal problems that you, the politicians, need to sort out. And it slightly concerns me where we're heading with this. And I just hope that people like Peter Lowell, who is a politician with a small p, mm-hmm. Actually picks up on this and spots it and has a word with the likes of Neil Doncaster, Rod Petrie, etc., and says, wait a minute, just let's be careful here in terms of what the Scottish Government are demanding of Scottish football.
I agree with everything that you've said there. And I think that we've also, several weeks ago, the SPFL put through a motion that wanted to give them more powers to make more decisions around COVID, and if something changes, that they can make decisions. It doesn't have to go to a vote where you need 75% of the teams. And it was unanimously voted down because the clubs don't trust the SPFL or the SFA to make the right decisions. So we're almost, by default, allowing government to run, and in inverted commas, as you say, Scottish football, because nobody else is running it. Itself, we're marking our own homework. The clubs are making decisions on the clubs. And I think until we get more powers, and don't get me started on that, but until we sort of rub out the SFA and the SPFL and draw it back in as one body with a commissioner and independent directors that have nothing to do with the clubs, that's the vicious circle that we find ourselves in. But it's always, we football are always an easy target for politicians. It really pisses me off.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think through to the logical conclusion, so imagine it came out in the press that the director of one of Scotland's biggest accountancy firms had gone for a jaunt to Spain and not quarantined. Would Nicola Sturgeon have stood up and said, the accountancy business better watch out that it's not suspended from operating? And that firm in particular, no staff are allowed to go into their offices or do any work for the next 2 weeks. Never in a million years would she do that.
No, and his privileged salary, his big house, his big car, and he'll be earning more than players at Aberdeen. You're absolutely right. It's just wrong. It's just plain wrong, Brian, that this is the way that this has been handled. And there's also an argument as well. I mean, if you're St Johnston, I think it was St Johnston Aberdeen were due to play, you've been punished, as we've been punished now, that we, like, as you read, we could potentially go 11 points behind Rangers before we play our next league game, potentially. But why punish St Johnston for that? They should be allowed to play their game, and if it means that Aberdeen don't have eight players, then they might have had tough shit. And for me, as soon as a positive test for COVID starts to get treated like a football injury, then we're going to be in this. I'll guarantee you there was players out last night doing things they shouldn't have been doing, eating and drinking. There must have been. I mean, there's over 1,000 players out last night, or that could be out last night. Several of them all been in the pubs and been in restaurants and been in people's houses. And it feels unfortunate. It feels inevitable to me that we're just one incident away from government saying, right, stop.
I think the other thing for me is about transparency as well. And again, something that I'd said on social media was that it's similar to what you're saying, Harry, in terms of, like, people misinterpret what you're actually saying on social media. Well, surprise, surprise, with only 280 characters to say what you want to say. But essentially, you know, I was saying, well, you know, the JRG have agreed these protocols with Scottish Football, and by definition, that means the clubs. But where's the transparency? We haven't, none of us see this in the public domain. So what is it that footballers can and clubs can and can't do that is different from the overall easing of lockdown rules and restrictions that the rest of us are supposed to adhere to? You know, clearly, yeah, the Aberdeen players were in the wrong in terms of what the rules are around the number of people from different families and groups that can meet together. But, you know, again, you know, Ballingulley was in the wrong in terms of the rules, but what else is there that has been agreed apart from the testing regime?
Mm-hmm.
And what was frustrating for me yesterday was, you know, why isn't the Celtic v Aberdeen game going ahead? The player involved with Celtic's been quarantined, or is mm-hmm. self-isolating, and as far as I know, the Aberdeen, because not all eight of the Aberdeen players were tested as positive.
Two
of them. So they will be quarantined and self-isolating. So as far as I'm aware, both clubs will have had the regime that has been put in place of testing, where clearly those tests have been negative because the SFA are releasing information about testing on their website. And obviously they're kind of like red lighting whenever they get any positive tests, which thankfully they've not had apart from the Aberdeen players. So why can't that game go ahead yesterday?
Yeah, and if you're the, I understand that the Nicola Sturgeon's asked a question in a press conference and is obligated to answer it, right? But the, for me, better answer would have been, it's not a good look. Scottish football will know it's not a good look. And I'm pretty sure they will have their, they've set up disciplinary processes to deal with that. Patently, if it was to continue, we'd need to have a serious conversation with them. That's all she needed to do. She didn't need to say, we'll not see those two teams playing for a week. Who is she to decide?
Yeah. And that then becomes political. She's taking that opportunity and yeah. She's saying that. And she starts talking about yellow cards and red cards. And I believe that Jason Leach, he had words as, I didn't miss them and hit the wall. How very dare you?
How very dare you?
These are people that are going to their work. Celtic have led the way in this. They've been very responsible. They've been right at the forefront in Scotland in sport in terms of taking this forward. Every single player, every single member of the staff is getting tested at least twice a week. There hasn't been a single positive test. They've spent hundreds of thousands of pounds doing the right thing. One player goes rogue and then it becomes a political football, literally. It's just wrong.
It gets, everything about it gets back to the reason why before the coronavirus, I was always against the principle of strict liability.
Yeah, because that's the point I'm making.
Because if I, as an entity, whether I'm a football club or an employer or whatever, if I do everything that is within my legal powers to restrict something happening, and it happens, and it's clear that it's not my fault, why hold me responsible for that? So I understand the principle of Jason Leach turning round to football and saying, right, okay, you've had a couple of incidents here, we're in a precarious situation, what steps were taken and have you taken? And Celtic turn around and say, well, what happened is, here's the guidelines we've laid out to all our players about what their behaviour is. Here is the rules that you've laid out as a statutory entity, but you've not stopped the flights. The flights can still go to and from. We have no legal right to stop Ballingulley getting on that plane. What we do have is the right to impose disciplinary sanctions on him if we find out that he did step on that plane, which the minute we did, that's what we've done. In fact, the guy's unlikely to be our employee in a short period of time. These are the steps we are taking. I think it's reasonable to say, right, okay, you know, I know there was some supporters online who want Celtic to have their players tagged with private private detectives following them round and camped, you know, with camped outside their house to keep an eye on them. But the reality is, once the guy leaves Lennoxtown, as was demonstrated, he can drive to the airport, jump in the plane, and be back again. And the next, and 2 days later, be in Lennoxtown. And how are Celtic to know he's done that?
I think the thing for me as well, going back to Duncan's point about Jason Leach, it's a dangerous road to be going down. Jason Leach is a government advisor. He's there to advise government, and it's for the government ministers then to actually speak with whichever stakeholders they need to. And as Duncan says, that kind of language that he was using in terms of his supposed media conference call with the club captains and the managers. Actually, that conference call should be with the club owners. It shouldn't be with the club captains and the managers. And for me, I don't know, this sounds trite, but for me, Jason Leach is all a bit of a, seems to be a bit of a celebrity trip for him. Yeah. And his job, as I say, is to advise government ministers. If Jim Fitzpatrick, as the Minister for Sport, needs to convey a message to Scottish football, should be him that does it, if it's not Nicola Sturgeon. But he's very, very, very concerning.
Yeah, and my concern is, you know, it's like anything in life. I had a client ask me to send a letter out for an issue that happened, which we did, and the client then came back and said, "Your letter wasn't strongly enough worded. I would have expected and wanted to." And I said to him, "If I start at that level, I've got nowhere to go." You know, if you start at the most, if you start at DEFCON 6 or whatever it is, you've got nowhere to go. So if you start with one player at Celtic breaks the quarantine rules and eight players at Aberdeen go for a meal when it should have been no more than three or four, whatever it is, then if you then say, because of that, there's no football play for 2 weeks, where do you go? After that, you started at an exceptionally high bar.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, it was James from 20 Minute Tim's did a thing, stuck a thing on Twitter the other day about Jason Leach had said the rules are very clear, and he said, "I don't think they are."
No, they're not.
And then proceeded to ask people what they thought the rules were for doing various things. And everybody's coming back saying different stuff.
Yeah.
And actually, because I've had an incident work-related that I have need to look into the rules, and I'll tell you what my, in terms of how vague the rules are, it was to do with how many people gathered outside to have a meeting, right? And somebody queried it. So I phoned the police, and the police said, don't really know. I don't think we would do anything about it, but phone this number. So I phoned that number, and that number was part of NHS 24. And the guy answering that said, have you looked at this government website? No, it doesn't cover this set of circumstances. I'm not really sure. Phone this number, which was some other public health body. They said, look at the government website. Doesn't really cover it. Oh, I'm not really sure. Phone the health and safety executive. Health and safety executive said, well, we wouldn't really have an interest in it, but I'm not really sure. Have you looked at the government website? No. Phone the local authority. Phone the local authority. I'm not really sure. Have a look at the government website. No, it doesn't cover it. Phone the police. Right? So the point I'm making there is, I went in a circle of everybody telling me to phone somebody else, because the point being, these were all the people in charge of the rules that when I asked them a set of circumstances about the rules, couldn't give me an answer and told me to phone somebody else. So the rules are not fantastically clear. But that then gets back to your point, Andy, about football then should create its own set of rules, make those public and say, these are the rules we are working by. Yep. These are the punishments for transgressions, and make it crystal clear.
Yep.
And in the public domain. And then you don't have people expecting our club to tag our players or have private detectives following them.
I think the other thing for me is as well is, and this is where, you know, kind of politics and football becomes let's say, best attention sometimes is that I think often politicians, they forget about the dimensions of football that we live with as supporters. It's about partisanship. It's about whataboutery. It's about all of those things that kind of like are not rational in the in the real world. And you know, you kind of see these incidents, and I mean, you've already seen it on social media. You say, oh, well, I've seen so-and-so in a pub with supporters, you know, who plays for X, you know, so let's grass them in. And before you know it, that escalates into another incident that then gets on the politician's desk. And before you know it, the politicians, they don't take all of that kind of partisanship and whataboutery into consideration and the irrationality of how football operates sometimes. And they'll just make these decisions. And before you know it, everybody, regardless of what team they support, will be thinking, what are you doing?
Yeah. So we've moved. So, Duncan, you don't think Bongoli will play for the club again?
No. No, I don't think he will. And I actually think that there's a loan move agreed for him with a price already agreed for him to move next season, is what I believe to be the case.
Problem is, he can't. I take it's in a country that if he went there, he'd have a problem coming back again.
I don't think he's allowed to come back. I mean, let's face it. The classy thing. I mean, you were saying about his employment rights. The classy thing to do, and I'm pretty sure that is grounds for gross misconduct, and you could just rip up his contract. The fact of the matter is, we paid a couple of million quid for him. Yeah. Business has got to come first, and you can imagine how Peter's dealing with this, and if he can get a wee fee for him and get him off the wage bill, then the classy thing would have been done to terminate his contract and just show him the door. But I think somebody told me yesterday, nobody at the club, but somebody told me yesterday that a loan move had been agreed for him to go to another country, and it had already been agreed that he would leave and sign for them at the end of the season after the loan. But
Touching on something you said earlier about he's a rubbish player, I mean, I actually think he's a better player than he's shown at Celtic, because he played 300 games for Rapid Vienna.
This is all in hindsight. When you sign a player that's played 300 games for Rapid Vienna, you think you're getting a decent player. It's logic. It's just, it might be, who knows, we could be watching him playing in the Champions League quarter final in a couple of years.
Well, because that's the thing I was going to touch on, actually. So, last night we had Moussa Dembele demonstrating what an absolute bargain buy he would have been if we'd have got three times his price. But again, for me, it's all relative. We sold Moussa Dembele for 20 million quid because the previous best price that we'd achieved was 12 million quid for a player. We then sell Tierney for 25 million quid because we sold Moussa Dembele for 20 million quid. There's an element of you can't go for selling players for 5 million quid to you suddenly sell someone for 50 million quid. It's really difficult. Yeah. Club, you know, there's an incremental movement, and that's just Sod's law of when we sold Dembele. But I don't know whether, you know, so I think part of Bolingoli's problem was he came to Celtic. It's a big environment, and that can be a pressure for people. And if you don't hit the ground running, it can be very difficult to ever get out of that vicious cycle of you're a shite player thought process in the fans. I wonder how the dynamic of world of football is changing by playing in empty stadiums. You know, I've often wondered if part of our problem of late of getting a doing from big clubs, you see Barcelona going and playing a lesser team somewhere else and they're playing at 60%. Because it's not a big deal. But when they come to Celtic Park, it feels like a big deal, so they play at 100% because actually the whole environment also raises their game. Yeah. I don't know your thoughts, Andy, about whether empty grounds might be part of the reason why Bayern Munich can go to Barcelona, can go technically, it was an away game. I mean, I know it wasn't, but technically it was, and thump Barcelona.
Well, yeah, I mean, not specifically on that game, but it's funny because I read something just prior to the Scottish season kicking off, and that was that I think it was might have been on Five Live actually, rather than reading it, and I can't remember who it was, but basically they were saying in terms of the closed door games, because of that lack of atmosphere and lack of fan environment. Essentially, what they were saying was that these games behind closed doors mean that the teams with the best players will win every game. And actually, Bayern confirmed that within the Bundesliga. Mm-hmm. So I watched quite a lot of the German football when that resumed because, you know, I just needed my football fix regardless of how it was kind of dished up. You could see that in the games in the Bundesliga. And then obviously when English football started, I think that's a bit of an outlier, English football, because I still think that technically it's not on a par with some of the other European leagues. Mm-hmm. So you did tend to get some kind of like weird results during those games. But what I was thinking was, from a Celtic perspective, was I was thinking, right, okay, when the season kicks off in Scotland, Celtic, you know, by anybody's definition, they've got the best squad in Scotland, and they've got squad depth. So all of the games that get played behind closed doors, Celtic probably got 90-95% chance of winning those games. Because as you say, opposition players who normally raise the game, either for home games against their home games against Celtic, or because they're playing in a big environment at Celtic Park, that just won't happen because there's that kind of flat environment to the games. Despite the Kilmarnock result, I think that will still play out until we start getting crowds back into the stadium. Going back to the Killy result, it just proves the point about the plastic pitches. So it wasn't about an empty stadium, it was about the quality of the playing surface.
Duncan, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've followed it quite, and I think what you guys are saying there, and I could have this wrong, but I think the stats actually point the other way. I remember when it started in Germany, they started to see some weird results, and then as it went on and as England started, they were showing stats that said, when a game of football starts, there's three outcomes, there's a home win, there's an away win, or there's a draw, and pre-COVID, typically a home win is 60% of the time, and it was somewhere around 45%. They were putting it down to no fans, so it's not as intimidating coming to Celtic Park for the likes of Hamilton or anybody else. And equally, there's not the pressure on the referees from the home fans, so decisions maybe aren't going the way of the home teams. And equally, I don't know, maybe if there had been fans at Rugby Park last week and the fans were really getting behind the team and getting at players, would they have lifted their game a wee bit more and gone for it? I don't know. It's an interesting point, though.
I saw that, Duncan. I think that's correct. I think the only thing for me is that the Bundesliga itself, across the league, there's a greater leveling of the teams. Obviously, Bayern and Dortmund and the like are kind of right up there, and Leipzig. But essentially, you're absolutely right. There were a lot more away wins than would have been normal. Yeah. But those away wins were coming from the teams that had largely better squads. So,
yeah, well, I mean, just on that, I mean, through my day job, I have quite a close working relationship with one of the major betting companies. And they've said that, and I asked them this question on this point, and they said that they are considerably up on their profits from football betting since football came back after COVID, which would tell me that either people are betting that don't know about football that didn't used to, or more likely, it's harder to pick a winner.
Fair enough.
So it's also going to be a very odd transfer window that we're going through just now. So, Andy, any particular areas you want the team strengthened?
We'd probably just take time to say I think it's good that we've got Vargas in. We needed a goalkeeper. I'm still disappointed that we didn't get Fraser Forster, But that appears as though that's Fraser Forster's decision for whatever reason. I think he's making a mistake. He'll look back on his career and he'll look back on what he achieved during his career, and everything that of note that he's achieved would have been with Celtic. So for him not to come back on a permanent basis or for another period is disappointing. But I know we talked about all of the negatives of the Kilmarnock game, but if there was one glimmer, it was the fact that in very early days, but in that kind of one cameo, Barkas, really when he got the ball, he was looking to distribute it very, very quickly, and you know, that kind of gave me a bit of confidence about what he could be for us. So that's good. I think the fact that we've got a Yeti in is good, because I think we've seen in the pre-season games and also when he came on against Hamilton, Klimala could possibly figure a lot more this season.
Mm-hmm.
So quite where Griffiths is going to be, who knows? But I think for me that means that we've got three decent quality strikers. So I think the pressure of needing a striker has kind of gone away. We need somebody in as a central defender, somebody who is of equivalence to Aya and Julian, so that they're really being pressured week in, week out in terms of retaining their first team places. And then I think, apart from that, we're okay. I mean, we've talked about Bolingoli. We probably need another left-back.
Yeah.
Now, because I'm not convinced about Greg Taylor. I like him. I think he's putting a lot of effort in. But there's certain parts of his game which I'm not too enamoured with. And some of that is not of his own making. His height, for instance, he is what he is height-wise, which doesn't always help. And he is, I'll always stick up for the completely one-footed left-foot players, seeing as I was one myself. But he is unbelievably one-footed. And Tierney was really, really dominant with his left foot. But when he needed to, Tierney would put a ball in with his right foot. Or pass with his right foot, and I've rarely see Taylor doing that. So we probably need strengthening there. And then I think the thing for me is, which I know other people have been chatting about in terms of the build up and the start of the season, is it's not about bringing a player in necessarily, but where is the kind of like medium to long term replacement of Bruni?
Yep.
And who is going to be that player that actually steps into Scott Brown's shoes over, and it will have to be at certain times over this season, I'm convinced of that. And if that player doesn't exist in the current squad, who and where are we going to get a player from who fills those boots? So that's where I would be with regards to, you know, who we need and where we currently are with the squad.
Duncan?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with most of what's been said there. I think we absolutely need another centre-half. If we are going to, if a preferred formation is going to be 3-5-2, then we need another centre-back. I don't think it would be a huge surprise if Chris Iyer moved on. I'd be very disappointed. But even if he doesn't move on, I still think we need another centre-half.
Yeah.
I know I'd be lying if I said I knew an awful lot about Shane Duffy. I must admit, when I seen this story, and this is true, I'm not being funny, I thought at first I wasn't sure whether it was Westlife or Boyzone. I didn't know which band he was in. and then I realised, oh no, he's a footballer. We definitely need another centre-half. I think we do need... a left back. I think I agree with what you said about Greg Taylor. He puts a shift in, and that goes a long way for me. But, and he'll probably be fine domestically, but I think we could be exposed at a European level. I actually do think we need another striker, because I don't think that we can rely on Lee Griffiths when he's fit and he's on it. He's a great goal scorer, but we can't rely on him. And Kamala, even though Kamala to me looks like he's done lockdown in Berlin, he's come back absolutely ripped and at it. But for me, my gut feel, having watched him a couple of times now, he's not good enough. I think he's going to be another striker that we're going to be talking about in a year or two that we spent a lot of money on and did nothing. I think we do need another striker to go. And again, that's assuming Edouard stays. I think if Edouard goes, we're banging trouble, because I don't think Kamala's the answer, and you simply cannot rely on Lee Griffiths. And then Ajeti, I don't know. I've never seen the boy play. I've looked at his stats. He seemed to have a very bad move to West Ham, and he was having a goal every other game when he was at Bale. I watched him on YouTube, but the thing with YouTube, everyone looks great on YouTube, but he actually reminds me very much. He looks to me like a Gary Hooper. That's the sort of player that I think he is, and if he is, then I'll be happy with that. But no, we need a centre-half, we need a left-back, and I think we need another striker. And that's, I also think it'll be surprising if we get to the window, and I think it's still got 2 months to go, and that we've kept, that if somebody asked me, will we have Aya and Cham, Edward, Christie, Rogic, are all five of those players going to be with Celtic when the window closes? I would doubt that. I would doubt that very much. So we do need reinforcements.
I agree with some of that. I think it's interesting that you mentioned Edouard, because I see all of the chat, particularly in the media, about whether Edouard is staying. And I've not seen anything in what Lenny has said. And okay, he'd say, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? But I just get the impression that regardless of any bids that Celtic might receive, that there's already been a decision that says Edouard is staying for this season.
I think a big thing there is, unlike maybe a lot of the other players that I mentioned there, I think deep down Edouard actually wants to be at Celtic and wants to be in Glasgow. He chose not to. I think he's got a girl in Glasgow that's local. He chose not to go back to France during lockdown. He stayed in Glasgow because he wanted to stay here. I think it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility to think that he thinks, no, I'll stay for this year and look at a move next year. But equally, I mean, let's face it, if somebody comes in, and I think last night when you see Dembele scoring 2 goals, my first thought is that makes it more likely that Edouard's going to go, because people look at the form of strikers from Celtic and they think, why wouldn't we pay 30 million? And I don't think, whether he wants to stay or not, I can't see Celtic. Not a lot. If a bid comes in for him at say £30 million, I cannot see the club say no.
I think the plan, and I think because we sold our season books, the plan stayed the same. I know the plan was no player was going to leave this summer, and we were going to add to the squad because we had so much money in the bank, we were actually going to spend it for once. And I think that once we sold all the season books, that plan was able to stay in place. But I believe we spoke to Edouard's agent about a contract where he commits to not leaving this year, and we would give him something like 10% of any sale fee that we get in. If we sold him then in the following summer, and I believe
I would assume that PSG will be getting a cut of any move as well. And when you think, we easily fall into the trap to think we're going to sit. Let's not forget, we paid nearly 10 for him. So if they get 30, that's 20 profit. We're already going to give a chunk of it away.
I believe it's 40. It's the level that we'll sell at. It's 40, and we were prepared. Basically, if he moves somewhere else, he might be able to earn, he may be able to get 80, 90, 100 grand a week.
Yeah.
So what we are trying to do is find a way to compensate him for not taking that 80, 90, 100 grand a week, by giving him that amount of money as a lump sum at the end of this season if he stayed. Right. And our figure was 40 million quid. So basically he'd be getting 4 million quid, that minimum. That was the idea. And apparently his agents have said, no, we're not interested in having that conversation about the contract.
It's the Larson testimonial deal then.
Yes, I think it's that type of principle that we were looking at. If you confirm that you're definitely going to stay for this year, I think they were trying to offer him an extra year on his contract to give us breathing space to not have to accept, you know, to give us breathing space next summer to negotiate the best deal that suited us best, because there was sufficient runway that if it didn't happen. And so his agent, I mean, that's not to say that he's in the mood to go. It's just, I believe that's made us think there's a greater chance that if an offer comes in, we'd have to accept it, because his agents aren't prepared to have a conversation about confirming that he'll definitely not be interested in moving this year, if you know what I mean.
But either way, we need another striker, I think. I do think we need another striker, centre half and left back. That's the three. That's on my Christmas list.
Yeah, I think left. You know, it's like anything. You could have a list as long as your arm. I think a centre half, because you're right. I think I might go. I wouldn't be surprised to see Ncham go, just simply because if I'm Ncham and I'm sitting on the bench and I'm a former French under 21 strike midfielder, I would be thinking I should be playing every week.
Well, Ncham on his day is an absolutely quality player.
Yeah.
And has actually showed in some of the European games that he is at a level that is, you know, pretty high, really. So, yeah, he probably does want first-team football every week.
I also got told this week that the Duffy thing, and I was like you, Duncan, I saw people putting Shane Duffy and thinking, is he a boys' own guy or something like that? Honestly, shows my ignorance of English football, actually. I'm only interested in Celtic. But I understand. Somebody sent me a thing saying that apparently he's signing for West Brom, and it's just his mates and Derry think it'd be a good laugh to play up the fact that he's going to sign for Celtic. But yes, I think we need a centre-half. I think we definitely need a left-back now, because obviously Ballingolli's never going to play again.
Well, I'll throw it in. Do you know who I would go and get for a year? And you're going to laugh at me. I'd go and get for a year Charlie Mulgrew. I'd bring him back. I would. Yeah. I think he'd be a great addition to that dressing room. He'd bring some grey hair, some fantastic grey hair, by the way, to that dressing room. And I think that he would be good for the Celtic team this season, for a season only.
I think he's too old. He's far too old.
Yeah. I'm not sure age matters too much when you're still playing professionally. I think it's more about the way he plays. I don't think he would fit into the style that Celtic play. I think if you look at the way in which let's go back to Strachan. If you look at the way the Celtic team plays now and look at some old footage, lengthy footage of the way in which Strachan's team played, it's completely night and day, the transformation of the style of Celtic play. And I just don't think Mulgrew fits into that style of playing. I think Mulgrew is a throwback to that kind of more combative type of football.
I think that's how Duffy is. I think Duffy, from what I've, because I did go away and look at him,
I agree with
is,
that.
He is a, I guess he's always been down as a no-nonsense centre half. He's exactly like that. And I know it's not going to happen with Charlie Mulgrew. I just think, and because he's got that option of being left-sided as well, it's fanciful, but I think we could do a lot worse. And equally, I don't know why we just don't go and buy Hickey at Hearts and Turnbull from Motherwell. We've got the money. These are going to be players that are going to go elsewhere, and we're going to be in the same way as we are with McGinn looking back, because we didn't go for 2, 3, 4 million, whatever the number was. I just don't understand the logic and how we recruit, and it just seems to take forever for us. We seem to take forever to do anything when it comes to recruitment. I'm not for a second suggesting that Rangers are a good business model, but they take several million on shirt sales and they go and buy two strikers. Now, they might be duds, I don't know, but they do it very quickly. We just seem to take days and weeks and months to do anything with a player.
I think that's a brilliant point about Hickey and Turnbull and the fees involved. And I think what we're realising, what you both said earlier on, is that this kind of like incremental increasing of transfer fees that we're receiving for our better players when we're selling them. But it appears as though we're still reluctant to accept that the value of players in Scotland that we're interested in, that if they are genuinely good players, that their price is increasing as well. And you know, regardless of where Hickey came from, i.e. through our youth system and we let him go, you know, if he's a good player now and his value is 3 to 4 million, then we should pay that. We should pay that. I agree with that.
Because we throw it at players, like you say, that come, if he was playing in another country, we'd buy him in a heartbeat. And we throw 2 to 3 million at Bios, at Kamalas, at Ballingollies. We spend 3 and 4 million on these players. But why wouldn't we, for a player that we know? I like to think that there's a master plan going on down at Celtic Park that can explain to me why that's not a no-brainer. But for me, it is an absolute no-brainer. Both those players. And there's another couple of good boys at Hibs as well. Why would we not scoop up the best players in Scotland? I mean, it's crazy.
I watched the Hibs game last night, or most of it. Is it Doig, the young? He's a young guy, left back, and I thought he looked pretty good, and he's getting some good reviews. So again, you know, I think he's only 17. Mm-hmm.
Which again also demonstrates, if he's 17 at Hibs, it means when he was 15 and 16, there was a better left back in Scotland at youth level, and he's at Celtic, because we hoover up all the youth talent.
Yeah.
Which then also demonstrates there is an issue with our youth players coming through to be first team players. And is it because they can get first team football at Hibs at 17? And they can't get first-team football, unless they're exceptional, like Kieran Tierney. They can't get first-team football at Celtic. And then their progression stagnates. And if that's the case, then in addition to your point, Duncan, about having a strategy, and you also mentioned that, Andy, you've got to, within that strategy, you've got to have a system as how do we get first-team games into our young players, you know, elsewhere. We've got to have a better way of loaning our players out to then come back and play first team football for us, to be able to get the first team. Or have a feeder club or something. Because
there is that, but the thing is, I mean, if you look at those kind of big English clubs now, I mean, it's frightening how many players they've got on their books and how many are out at various other clubs. And I suppose Celtic are following that model on a lesser basis. And the thing for me is, I don't know whether we just have to accept that football's hit and miss. Mm-hmm. And these grand designs of strategies and things like that, you know, maybe that's not what football can cope with, because it is about kind of week-to-week stuff very often. But, I mean, McGregor and Christie are perfect examples of young players who we've got, and we've then put them out on loan for extended periods, and they've come back to become regulars in the first team.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe Bio will come back and be a regular in the first team. Or did we actually punt? Did we actually sell him?
He's gone out on.
I know. Is it a loan, or is it a loan with an option to buy?
It's a loan with an option to buy.
All right. Okay. So obviously not Bio. Which then gets back to the, you said there about football's a hit and miss game. I saw this online, and it demonstrated one of the challenges. People used to talk when Brendan Rodgers was manager about how it was basically Ronnie Dyla's team that Brendan Rodgers was fielding. It wasn't really changing much. Here's the players that Brendan Rodgers came in under. Brendan Rodgers, Scott Sinclair, Ebuwe Kouassi, Christian Gamboa, Christopher Ayer was technically signed under Brendan Rodgers, but he came in under Rory Dyer. Moussa Dembele, who was coming in under Rory Dyer. Kolo Touré, Doris de Vries, Olivier Ncham, who we were scouting before Brendan arrived, Charlie Musonda, Jack Hendry, Johnny Hayes, Marvin Compa, Lewis Morgan, Kendai Benyu, Burke, Benkovic, Arzani, Tol Yan, Weah, Molumbu.
God.
Yeah.
Imagine you start putting some numbers next to them, Brian, in terms of transfer and wages.
Yeah.
And again, most of those players, if not all of them, are all foreign players. When you go after a Hickey or a Turnbull or a McGinn, you know what you're getting. They're not going to have that trouble settling into Scotland because they're already here. It feels like it is a hit or a miss for me. And I listened to your last podcast, Brian, that you did with the stats guy in America. I've been into this for a long time, but I don't get that people don't get it, that this data is, I mean, the world's run by data, whether it be politically or sport. Data is like, it's the new oil. And you have to, take a punt and a player every now and then, but you should have a system that is derived from data for recruitment and for retention. It's an absolute no-brainer. And you do take a punt and plug a hole when you have to. But it's, you look at a team like Atalanta, who went all in on the big data model, let's call it that.
Yeah.
And they're within 90 seconds of a Champions League semi-final the other night. It can't be, we need to sign three players to get one good one. It can't, that's your flat.
And also the concept that you have one guy who, in inverted commas, has got an eye for a player. It can't be. That was fine 30-plus years ago when your marketplace was on your doorstep or maybe England. But when you're choosing from the whole world, one guy patently just can't look at the whole world. So you need to boots on the ground. And because if you don't have boots on the ground with scouts in those places and gaining all that data information, somebody else is going to get players before you, which means you're not getting the pick of the players. Because you're obviously hearing about them after other people will have heard about them. Mm-hmm. Other people who do boots on the ground and do have that data analytics coming through.
And again, I don't know that we Celtic have in that department. I've been up at Lennox Town and there are some people that are working on data, but I think they're more working on the data for the next coming game in terms of who you're playing against. And I don't see them, and why they're not, again, obviously there's a master plan down there that isn't shared with us mere mortals, but why have we not got like £1 million a year budget and employing like two like Harvard mathematicians, quant physicists that are sitting in there churning these things and looking at data? I don't think we're doing that. And much like many things in football, by the time you start doing it, it's too late. Scotland's done it at a national level. Well, let's go and see what they're doing in Holland. By the time you go to Holland, it's too late because it's actually Spain you needed to have gone to. And now Spain's maybe moving on. It's where's the next big thing? And this is like turning an oil tanker. You can't just switch this on. And it feels like whatever happens this season, hopefully we'll go on and win 10 in a row. But whether we do or we don't, I just get the feeling there's a lot of big changes coming at Celtic off the pitch. And on the pitch, I think a few players will go. I think we could see potentially change of ownership. I think we could see change of CEO. I think everything's going to change in Celtic in the next couple of years. And I'd like to think that we've already started this journey on data, but I don't think we have. And that's terrifying for me.
I mean, I think that's probably right. I think the thing for me is, as well, is kind of knowing a little bit about how the football industry works and the actual organisational structure of many football clubs is still in the kind of dark ages. And Celtic, even though it's a PLC, even though it's got supposedly shareholder accountability, it still operates on that basis. You can see from its structures, you can see how everything still goes through the CEO. So it's not just about data, it's actually about structure. And I think we'll only ever see that change if we get a change in CEO, which I think is, you know, by definition in terms of the age of the current CEO, and possibly if we achieve 10, then there's more of a likelihood that that will change.
I was convinced he was going to go this summer if we achieve the 10. Getting back to your point, Andy, his age, he's going to go shortly anyway, because he's not going to be CEO of Celtic at 66, 67. So I think he's 62 this summer. Mm. And it would have been that would have been an appropriate time. I wouldn't have been surprised, and I don't think it would have been good. I understand the principle of you're not going to, he's well connected, he's got influence in European club organisations, so you wouldn't want to lose him to the organisation. No. So I wouldn't have been surprised actually if he stepped up to become non-exec chairman. Mm-hmm. My only issue with that would be having the former CEO as non-exec chairman, if you then just promoted from within for one of the current candidates, there would still be a boss-employee relationship between the CEO and the chairman, and then the chairman's non-exec, so I don't think that would be healthy for that to happen.
I mean, my experience is in those kind of, you know, kind of at boardroom level and at executive level, if you're going to make a cultural change to the organisation, you can't have the CEO then going into some kind of like non-exec role.
No, you can't.
Within the organisation, it's got to be a clean break, and with that clean break may come somebody who ruffles a few feathers, but ultimately ruffles those feathers to actually get the organisation into a more appropriate footing and modern footing.
Because you would just have conflict, because
correct,
if you had that and Peter became chairman, Peter would still be about the place, he would still pick up the phone to people, he would still have somebody saying, oh, should I be giving this to him? And then you would have the new chief CEO finding out that somebody had given information to Peter before him. The new CEO would then be saying, what the fuck are you doing? I'm supposed to get that. Then the poor employee in the middle feels awkward, because it would just be a recipe for disaster. For me, what you need is a clean break. Yeah. You need a new CEO. You need a proper director of football who's in charge of football operations out with the first team responsibilities. Yeah. And you need that football operation. I remember being at a presentation. It was Ronnie Dyler talking to, it was a fans group thing. And Ronnie Dyler said, the point about how Atalanta are bridging that gap that you just mentioned, Duncan, Ronnie Dyer said, we can't financially bridge the gap, but at the level that you pay sports psychologists and physiotherapists and sports scientists and other backroom people, there is no reason why we can't have the best backroom team, or a backroom team that's on a par with the more elite clubs. Yeah. Because we can pay on a par with them for those people's wages and be the very best you can be on sports science and medical data and medical information. And I don't think we are the best we could be in our backroom world.
I would agree with that 100%. In every instance, whether it be coaches or data scientists, I don't believe we have.
And I think the biggest barrier to that change is that it's so easy for those who are currently in control and managing the situation to say, well, it's working because we've won 9 in a row.
Yeah, that's from easy issue. It's very difficult. We've won 9 in a row. Yeah. We are 2 wins away from a quadruple treble.
Yeah.
And we've got £40 million. Well, it won't be £40 million after coronavirus, but you know, get my principle, and we've got £40 million in the bank. Tell me what we're doing wrong. Yep. Well, I think we could have £60 million in the bank, and I think we could have reached a quarter final of a European competition.
I agree.
Organisations rarely change when they perceive that they're in a period of success.
Yeah, but you fix the roof while the sun's shining, though, right?
Oh yeah, I agree. I'm not defending the club. I'm rationalising it in terms of why they will be reluctant to change under the current regime.
Yeah, and I just think it'll take more than a seat. I think it actually needs ownership change. I think when you look at our board, you look at our CEO, you look at our biggest shareholder, there's a certain profile of age and skill set that's there and not there.
I think it needs a
root and branch change of ownership, and that everything, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but that we have a different approach, because we need to think about how, because I think we're getting left behind at peer level. We're getting left behind, and I don't think we've got peer level in Scotland. I'm talking about in Europe. I think we're getting left behind. But I tell you what, worryingly, Rangers get this. Rangers, because Liverpool got it and Klopp got it, therefore Gerrard got it. Rangers have and are going down that route because they know they can't compete with us financially. Therefore, they need to find a way of getting an edge that isn't finance. And they're going all in on this. I sent you a job, Brian. I don't know if you've applied for it. I sent you a job at Rangers. I sent you a job at Rangers. And it's exactly what you described. It's like, it's a data scientist, like quant mathematician. They're going in on this more than we are because they feel they have to in order to bridge the gap. That doesn't keep me awake at night, but I think about it every now and then.
Yeah, funnily enough, I did see that. I saw that doing the rounds, that job. And I kind of did think, I doubt if we're doing anything like that at the moment.
Yeah, it's worrying. You would just go to Atalanta and find out whoever the number two is there and just give them $500,000 a year and bring them to Glasgow. To make sure they quarantine for a couple of weeks over to get here.
Right. Well, on that sort of slightly downbeat end to the podcast, I just noticed the time, so I need to head off. So I will say, Duncan and Andy, thanks very much.
Cheers, Harry.
Thank you. It was absolute pleasure, gents. Thank you very much.
Yeah, cheers, Duncan.
Bring me sunshine in your smile.
Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Hope you're all keeping well. As I record this, we recorded it in the morning. In the afternoon, the Rangers have dropped points on another plastic pitch of purgatory at Livingston. And so, with the exception of the fact that they played games when we were not allowed to, all things are equal at this very early stage of the season. Anyway, you may have noticed, if you were looking online, the 9 for 9 with the Celtic FC Foundation. If you didn't see it, go online, see what you can do if you're in a financial position to give any help to the fantastic work they are doing. So go to Google Celtic FC Foundation and see what you can do. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady. That was Duncan and Hullboy. And I'll say goodnight and God bless. Good night.
In your smile, bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me